This is about apologetics, which is basically defending the faith. So if you came to something on apologetics and thought it was going to be on how to apologize well, you had a relationship you needed to fix or something like that, this is not the session for you, okay? That would be one of the other sessions. This is not on apologizing, but on apologetics. And so we're going to look at what apologetics means, and particularly what I call gospel-centered apologetics. So let's take a look, and I want us to wrestle through with this. First off, simply, what is apologetics? What do we mean when we speak of apologetics? Now, the Greek word apologetics, or apologia is the actual Greek word. It means simply saying or in response, something you speak in response, or it means a defense is basically what it means. Something you speak in response or a defense. In Greco-Roman usage, particularly in the Greek court systems, what is used, the word is used often as an opposite of kategoria. Okay, there's another word, kategoria, that is the opposite. And the kategoria was the accusation brought against somebody. So you had an accusation brought against, which is the kategoria, and the response that you made to defend yourself was the apologia. So it assumes when you speak of an apologia, what you assume is that somebody has made an attack and you are responding in some sense to that attack. That's what it assumes. Now, the interesting thing about that, using that in apologetics in the way we use it, is the interesting thing about that is that it assumes that the world around us will be hostile to the message we proclaim. It just assumes that. Rightly assumes that. The word apologetics assumes that as a whole, the world around us is going to be hostile to the claims that we are making. And so the apologia was simply a saying in response, a defense that lets us know, as it's used in the New Testament, that what we speak is the world will resist that at some level. Now, it's used several times in the New Testament. I'm not going to look at all of these that I've listed right here, but I do want to look at a couple of these, particularly in Philippians. Those earlier examples from Acts chapter 22, Acts chapter 25, 2 Timothy 4, all of those examples, those are drawn from that other usage I spoke about a courtroom defense or simply a defense against an accusation. These others, Acts 22 or Philippians chapter 1 verses 7 and 16, are more the way that we are using it in our context. So let's take a look at those. Philippians chapter 1 verses 7 and 16. Here's what we read in those texts there. Paul says, "It is right for me to feel thus about you, because I hold you in my heart. You are all partakers with me of grace, both in my imprisonment and in the apologia and confirmation of the gospel." In other words, the Philippians were partners with Paul in defending the gospel of Jesus Christ, in speaking it with clarity to the world around them. Then farther on, down in verse 16 of this same text, it says there that some, these latter do it out of love. He speaks of those who speak Christ, and some do it out of envy, some do it out of goodwill. It says the latter, those who do it out of goodwill, do it out of love, knowing that I am put here, I'm put in prison, for the apologia of the gospel, because he has defended, or for the sake of, more likely, the apologia of the gospel. In other words, Paul says, the reason I have been placed in this place, in prison or under house arrest, is because I am to defend, I am to speak the gospel and defend it. The other text, 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15, is the familiar one, in which, in that text, it says, always have a defense or an apologia ready. So that's the word apologetics, from which we get apologetics. So you see your apologetics is a defense. It can be used in some sense for defending yourself against false charges, but it can also be used for defending the gospel of Jesus Christ, defending the truth of God. Now, the primary aim of Christian apologetics, I want us to unpack this a little bit as we understand this. The primary aim of Christian apologetics is not to prove that Christians are correct. It's not to prove you're correct. Now, one of the things we often do, and it's that fleshliness rising up in us at times, where we are defending the faith, and we end up, as we're defending the faith, really defending ourselves. And I want to win. I want to be proven right. It's the same feeling you feel if you're married and when you have a discussion with your spouse and a disagreement, or if you have a close friend or something like that you're having this disagreement with, and you feel that rising in you of, I'm going to be right, I'm going to win, I'm going to win this. And I know that probably most of you never felt that with anything or anything like that, but I do. Okay, I feel that at times, where I just want to win. All of us, truth be told, we have that at times. But the primary aim of Christian apologetics is not to prove ourselves correct. It's not to prove ourselves or even Christians as a whole correct. The focus of apologetics is not of ourselves or of Christianity, but of Jesus Christ. Neither is it, on the hand, to primarily prove the Bible is correct. Now, I say primarily because there is a sense in which it is about proving the Bible correct. But what I mean by that is the point of it is not simply to say we've got the whole Bible right here and we've got to defend every little part of the Bible. There is a place for that, but the primary aim of Christian apologetics is not simply to defend the accuracy of the Bible, though there is a place for that. The reason I say that is because that what we can do then is get caught up in a discussion that can go nowhere good, in which somebody is saying, well, what about this verse? What about this verse? What about this verse? What about this verse? And you can't, there's no way for that to come to a productive end at that point, because eventually, simply out of the fact that none of us are omniscient, they will stump you at some level. When you're doing that, that type of an apologetic really is a losing proposition, not because the Bible isn't true. Clearly, I believe the Bible to be utterly and absolutely true, but simply because it is not a way that we can really aim toward what really matters in the text of Scripture. We can't really aim for what matters when we're doing this. I would also say the primary aim is not of apologetics to get somebody converted, to get somebody to trust Christ. In that, and what I mean by that is that that you cannot accomplish that. That is God's work to convert them. That is God's work to bring their heart to life in such a way that they respond in faith to Jesus Christ. That is something that God alone can do. You can't cause that to happen in your presentation. You can testify to the truth. You can testify to it faithfully, but you cannot cause them to be converted. What you can do is present them with a winsome case. And here's what building on that. The purpose of Christian apologetics primarily is to testify faithfully to the coherence and the historical integrity of the gospel message. I would suggest that is our primary aim, is to testify faithfully, to speak this truth with faithfulness and accuracy to the coherence and the historical integrity of the gospel message. That is our primary aim in apologetics. Now, that changes the way we do things. That means that we don't just try to see, well, is this verse right or wrong? This verse right or wrong? Is this verse true or false? Can I prove this one? Can I not prove this one? That's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to demonstrate that the gospel message as presented in Scripture is coherent. That is to say, it fits together, it meshes together with life and with itself, and it is historically, there is a level of historical integrity to it, that it is, there's something that you can trust about it. It is trustworthy, might be another word that we would say. That, I would suggest, is the primary purpose of apologetics. But we raise this word, the gospel, and I've probably mentioned it two or three times already. And we live in a world in which we need to ask ourselves and present clearly, what is the gospel? What is the gospel? We have to be able to testify to that. So I want to spend a few moments simply unpacking that to inform what we do in apologetics. Now, what is the gospel? The actual word for gospel or good message, fortuitous message, good news in the New Testament is euangelion. We get evangelize and words like that from it. Is euangelion. Euangelion, what that word means is it was often used outside the New Testament for the message that a king had won the victory. That's what it was often used for. Our king has won the victory. That's one of the primary usages of the word, is that our king has won. In other words, so when we are speaking of the gospel of Jesus, we often miss some of these echoes from the original context of it. Because when the people then heard the message of their euangelion of Jesus, there is an implication that he is a victorious king. He is victorious. He is the victor. That's what the gospel is at its core. It's that message of that. Now, in terms of unpacking it a little bit more, a guy named Joe Thorne has done a great definition. My favorite definition that really pulls the different strands together of a full definition of the gospel. And I want to read this to you. The gospel is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. I want to stop there for just a moment. The gospel is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. The gospel is not what the person responds to this message, whether it be a prayer, or whether it be that you lead them through a series of Bible verses, or it be that you lead them through something else as they come to faith in Christ. Those may at times be helpful tools to use, but they are not the gospel. Get that very clearly. They are not the gospel. This when you try to lead someone to Christ and they may something that they may respond in terms of a prayer or something like that, that is something that God may use, but it's not the gospel. That's the response to the gospel. The gospel is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus that accomplishes redemption and restoration for all who believe and for all of creation. In his life, Jesus fulfilled the law and accomplished all righteousness on behalf of sinners who have broken God's law at every point. In his death, Jesus atones for our sins, satisfying the wrath of God and obtaining forgiveness for all who believe. In his resurrection, Jesus' victory over sin and death became the guarantee of our victory over sin and death in and through him. Jesus' saving work not only redeems sinners, uniting them to God, but also assures the future restoration of all creation. This is the gospel, the good news, that God redeems a fallen world by his grace. And I like that definition. It's a good definition. It's a full definition, I realize, but it is a good definition that points us to that what is central about the gospel is not the response, but the Savior who evokes the response. That is what it is, the life, death, resurrection of Jesus as applied to humanity. Now, thinking through the apologetics side, talked about the gospel side, I want to talk about the apologetics side. Three approaches to Christian apologetics. One of those I would call presuppositionalism. Presuppositionalism. It's difficult to give a short definition of presuppositionalism, but I'll do my best to do that. Presuppositionalism is the idea that the Christian worldview and the worldview of the unbeliever are so fundamentally dissimilar. They are so different that there really is no way to build a bridge between them. Rather, all that can be done is to recognize the incoherence of the non-believer's worldview, is to recognize and to demonstrate and to point out the incoherence of their own worldview, the fact that their own worldview doesn't cohere internally, it doesn't make sense, it doesn't work in life, and so the way to witness is to witness to Jesus Christ by means in such a way that it will show the worldview of the unbeliever, how it falls short of what God has created us to do and to be. But the two worldviews are so separated that there's not a way to build a direct bridge between the two. Now, another view of apologetics is what I call logical evidentialism. Logical evidentialism are the classical proofs for God, or supposed proofs for God. The ontological argument that in which there is none greater and all that those things there. We won't get into that at this point on that. But there's one called the ontological argument, the cosmological argument. One you're probably more familiar with is the teleological argument, which is that there is sufficient orderliness in our world, that order is points to some sort of an intelligent creator or intelligent designer. That's the idea of teleological argument. So the idea that there are ways that we can demonstrate God through, or the necessity of God through, logic, philosophy, things like that. There's also what I would call historical evidentialism, that being the idea that historical evidences point to the likelihood of events that can only be explained by a divine being. Okay, the different things that have happened in history, there are things testified to in history that point to some sort of divine being having had to been involved. That's historical evidentialism. Now, of those three, I find any one of those by themselves to be inadequate. So I want to unpack a different approach to apologetics besides these three that does, in fact, though, draw from different components of these. A gospel-centered apologetic. Apologetics centered in the gospel, what I want us to think first is that it would recognize that the presuppositions of the believer and unbeliever, just like presuppositionalism at this point, are indeed fundamentally contradictory to one another. They're just totally separated from one another. They're split from one another. The presuppositions, our worldviews, are fundamentally contradictory. And yet, and here's the difference right here, it also recognizes that no unbeliever lives completely consistently with his or her own worldview. No unbeliever does. Let's think of some different ways of that. In terms of theism and the belief that human beings are created in God's image, let's think of something. If you've got a street that somebody's driving down that street and they see in front of them a cat and they see in front of them a human being and that they will swerve and they are going to probably hit one or the other when they swerve and they must in that split instant choose one or the other, people will choose to hit the cat rather than the human being, even if they would say that human beings are ultimately an animal that is no different, simply a highly developed animal. Well, what is that revealed about their worldview? They may say that there is an equivalence of value, but when forced to make a decision between the two, they will tend toward one versus the other. So in other words, there's a contradiction within their worldview. Another example of this would be that often, and we'll unpack this a little bit more later, but often the Gospels are not treated the same way we would treat any other historical texts. In other words, there's a tendency for applying a standard of evidence to the Gospels that would never be applied to any other text in this, or to apply a standard for the copying of them that would not be applied to any other text. In the biblical text, we have less than 1% of variance between different manuscripts of the New Testament, less than 1%. Well, that's far less than any other ancient document, far less than any other ancient document. The earliest manuscript related to the time of writing, so the New Testament being written in the first century, and the earliest fragment of the New Testament comes from the late first or early second century, a papyrus 52 of John chapter 18. And you get full manuscripts by the end of that century, so less than 200 years, you have full manuscripts of books, of different books of the New Testament. That's far closer to the time of writing, and yet often a different standard is applied, saying, well, that's a problem for the New Testament. Well, it's a problem for Thucydides, who it's centuries afterwards that you've got the first copy of this. Who it's a problem for is Homer's writings, that for the textual criticisms of those. That's a problem that comes centuries afterwards. New Testament, far less. So that would be a way that there is a contradiction within worldviews, is saying we're going to try to apply a different standard to the New Testament than we apply to any other ancient document in this. It recognizes no unbeliever lives consistently with his or her worldview, and this is because the gospel is odious to the unbelieving world. I mean, it really is what it comes down to at the deepest level. I've got a guy that I see two or three times at Starbucks each week, and he's an unbeliever. And the fascinating thing is he's probably 78 years old. I think he's pretty old. And so this older man, he is a very intelligent man. He's an unbeliever, and he does not want to talk about Jesus. As soon as you start to move the conversation towards Jesus, he automatically will come up with anything. The other day, and I wish I were making this up. I'm not making this up. The other day, he said something about whether it was okay with God for him to count his money on Sunday. And so he'll come up with these questions like this all the time. And I talked to him and said, I don't think God's really concerned about that. And then I took that next step, as I often do with him, and went to that next step of saying, you know what God's really concerned about is whether we've been made right with him, and Jesus is the only. And so he starts talking about, says, you know what? God really has given me a gift. He said, one time I went up and I petted an elk, and I've got really a gift with it. This guy would rather talk about elk petting than to talk about Jesus. That's what it comes down to. And that's the unbelieving world around us, where you'd rather talk about elk petting than about the gospel. And yet that's exactly that type of separation that people have in terms of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But apologetics centered in the gospel recognizes then, though, that since the unbeliever, and this is the important part right here, the unbeliever doesn't live consistently with his own worldview. So here's the thing. Even in the unbeliever's worldview, there are fragments and pieces and islands, we might say, of a theistic and indeed a Christian worldview. They've got fragments of it all over in them. And what we must do is build a bridge, so to speak, not to their fallen and false worldview, which is utterly and fundamentally opposed, but to locate those places where they have fragments of a theistic or a Christian worldview particularly, and build bridges there. That's what we do. That's what we seek to do in proclaiming in the gospel and in providing apologetics for its truth. Now, because the gospel was an event in which God himself transformed history by entering history, this evidence will be primarily historical evidence. So what I'm basically doing is steering kind of a path between presuppositionalism and historical evidentialism. That's basically what I'm doing in this. Is steering a path between those two, saying that it is possible to build a bridge, but not because their worldview really isn't inconsistent with ours. It really is inconsistent with ours. But there are fragments of a Christian worldview in theirs, and we can build bridges between them, but this evidence will be primarily historical. Now, I want to take another step even beyond this, though, and talk about gospel-centered, that it must be not simply arguing biblical history as a whole, or making an apologetic for that, but it must be rather centered in the gospel in the event of Jesus Christ. Remember, the gospel is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And that's where we have to head, and that's what I want to unpack in the rest of our time together. If you walk through my head, as frightening as a thought as that may be, and indeed it truly is, all there is in there is charts. I don't have any words in there. There's only charts. And so it's all charts. And so this is the kind of a chart to summarize what I'm talking about right here, is that in everything that we do, we aim toward discussion of and talking about and providing an apologetic for the gospel, the redemption, life, death, resurrection of Jesus. Now let's talk about just practically what that means. These are the four movements of God's story: creation, fall, redemption, and consummation. Some of you may be familiar with this, and some of you may not be, but that's what we often summarize as the four movements of God's story. This is really important, I think. It's so important that I even teach at Sojourn Community Church, where I teach the children and work in children's ministry. I teach the kids almost every week this right here. Now, do I teach them to say creation, fall, redemption, consummation? No. So I'll teach you the easy way that I teach them how to do this, okay? It's God made the world good. Sin made the world groan. Jesus broke the power of sin, and God will make the world new. So we go through that each week so that they understand and think in terms of creation, fall, redemption, and consummation. Because that's basically what we're talking about, is God made the world good, sin made the world groan, Jesus broke the power of sin, and God will make the world new. Now, when we are working with somebody, guiding them toward the gospel, or guiding them toward what we believe to be truth, and I want us to guide them toward the gospel, often we can, for example, get caught up in the movement of creation, for example. We may argue to no end with somebody about creation. But if you convince somebody that God really created the world, and let's suppose that you even convince somebody God created the earth a few thousand years ago in a very short period of time. Let's suppose you prove that, you demonstrate that. Let's suppose you do. They're still no closer to accepting Jesus. And in fact, they may rework that knowledge in such a way in their own worldview as to lead them deeper into idolatry, if we have that by itself. Now, is that a discussion for us to have? Yeah, it's a discussion for us to have. But it's also one that we recognize even Christians have different views of, and we must spend our time and aim people toward, when that discussion starts, go as quick as you can to the life, death, resurrection of Jesus. Don't camp there. Don't spend your time there. Don't just work all your time there. Go to what really will make eternal difference in their lives. Go to that. Because they could agree with you on this one and end up being somebody who is a deist. They could have been in a vague theist. They could be a Jew. They could become a Jewish person. They could become a Muslim. They could become any of these things, couldn't they? And agree with you at some level, some way, at this one. So they're no closer to Jesus as a result of this. Or we can get caught up in the fall, for example. That is to say, caught up in the issue of the problem of evil and arguing about why is there evil in the world. And you might be able to come up with all sorts of logical reasons why God could and should allow evil in the world. And they may be able to say, I understand now why God allows evil in the world and why he allows sin. But unless you've aimed them toward the gospel and the life, death, resurrection of Jesus, all you've done is helped them reframe what they're already thinking about in a different way maybe to provide a reason for God doing what he does, but they're still no closer to Jesus. Consummation, the end of time. People want to talk about the end of time. And sometimes Christians get all caught up, again, in arguments with somebody about the end of time and how the world will end and why it will end that way and all of that. Are those profitable discussions? For some context, yeah. But if you spend your time there and you convince them of how the world will end, but you don't point them toward the one that will bring it to an end, they're still no closer to Jesus. Everything we do, don't get bogged down in all these other issues. Head straight for Jesus. See, because you can do one of two things. You can try to argue every little story in the Old Testament being true. Or you can go to Jesus, and if they trust Jesus and trust the words that Jesus said, he says, your word is truth. He says, Scripture cannot be broken. He says over and over that Scripture is true, and he speaks of the Old Testament when he does that. And so we can accept on the authority of Jesus that the Old Testament is without error. Or you can try to go through the whole Old Testament and try to argue everything that's in the Old Testament. Or you can aim at Jesus, and you can let him take care of it for you and state it for you. It's going toward that movement of redemption. Now, we're not probably going to get to all three of these, but I want to show you some foundational claims and foundational things that we can help people understand to aim them toward the life, death, resurrection of Jesus. Some things that ways we can argue for in a winsome and loving way, we can argue for the truth of who Jesus was and did and what he said. We can argue for that in a way that presents that aims them in that direction. I want to suggest to you that testimony about Jesus was formulated soon after his death and circulated reliably. That's a claim that I believe we can make and that we can defend and that we can present to people and that we can use to aim directly for Jesus and the gospel. That testimony was connected to eyewitnesses. We won't be able to dig into that as much as I want to today just because of time. And it was reported in independent accounts that agree on vital details. That's what I want us to unpack. And these are just three. You could add other things to this list. These are three things that I want us to unpack and think through in a way that when somebody is asking questions, we can aim them toward Jesus and talk about that. Because here's the deal. If we can demonstrate to somebody the likelihood that Jesus really rose from the dead, most of us, I think, can say that we've never had anyone rise from the dead. Okay? I think that's a pretty universal experience that we don't have a lot of people rising from the dead around us. So if, in fact, Jesus rose from the dead, and if, in fact, the testimony about him in the Gospels truly reports what he said, that he has some connection with the source of life that I don't have in terms of immediately or directly, some type of a connection with the source of life that I don't have immediate or direct access to. Therefore, I should listen to what he has to say. See the logical sequence right there, moving through that, thinking through that. So it's like, okay, if Jesus really rose from the dead, he has access to a source of life that I do not have immediate and direct access to. In the same way that he did anyway. Therefore, if I can find his words and what he said, I should listen to them and obey them. I should hear what they have to say about my life and about the lives of others. Therefore, point to Jesus. Point to Jesus. I want us to unpack some of those things as to how to do this. First off, the central claims of the gospel originated rapidly and circulated reliably. That's the first, that's the easier way of saying that first one I said. Central claims of the gospel originated rapidly and circulated reliably. You have proof of this in your hands, if you have your Bible with you. You have proof of it, and we'll unpack that in a little bit. A guy named Bart Ehrman, who is an agnostic, has this to say. This is an example. This isn't just unique to him. Other people have made the same claim, but he states it in a rather memorable way. Stories based on eyewitness accounts are not necessarily reliable. And the same is true a hundredfold for accounts that, even if stemming from reports of eyewitnesses, have been in oral circulation long after the fact. Imagine playing telephone. You know the telephone game, you whisper and it goes to somebody. And when I was little, I always hated that game and I'd make up something in the middle of it. Like saying my teacher's hair looks like a mangy Wookiee's armpit or something like that. So it didn't work that well. But anyway, over the expanse of the Roman Empire, some 2,500 miles across, with thousands of participants from different backgrounds, with different concerns, and in different contexts over the course of decades. But what I want us to see is that they lived in what's called an oral traditioning culture. You see, when something happens in our world, it goes into print or on digital or paper, one or the other, almost immediately, doesn't it? They didn't live that way. They did not live that way. In fact, they placed a higher premium on that which was passed from person to person to person by an oral history than they did on what was written. That's why the Gospels don't get written down in the form we have them until the apostles start dying out. The original eyewitnesses are dying out. We've got to get it in written form so that it doesn't change as it goes. But as long as they were alive, they kept it in an oral form and spoke it person to person to person to person. It's a fundamental misunderstanding of the cultural background of this. Because in the cultural background, an oral tradition and culture is going to prefer the oral way of passing a story rather than a written manner. That's simply what they're going to do in their culture. And so you find that in there. And in fact, even in our world today, there are places where this type of traditioning happens even today. I worked with Native Americans, the Lakota people, in South Dakota at one time. And one of the things I learned in that is that they have storytellers in their culture who have gotten stories that have been passed down 200 and 300 years with almost no changes in those stories. 200 and 300 years, they've passed them down. Why? Because that's still the part of their culture in their area and in their context. That's part of their culture still to this day in this. In the New Testament culture, that's how they were passing on information. And so to say that just because they're passing it on verbally in this way does not mean that it became unreliable. Further says in another context, the New Testament Gospels were written 35 to 65 years after Jesus, which is in fact probably correct, not by people who are eyewitnesses. And that's very much, that's a questionable claim right there that, as I said, we won't get as much into as I want to. But by people living later, after the days of Jesus, people started telling stories about him in order to convert others to the faith. Stories were changed with what would strike us today as reckless abandon. They were modified, amplified, embellished. And sometimes they were even just made up. That's the claim that Bart Ehrman makes at this point. I want us to think through this, especially that last phrase that they were made up in that way. There is strong evidence that a stable oral history of the crucial events of Jesus' life emerged less than 3 years after his death, and that the essential content of this oral history remained unchanged as it spread across the Roman Empire. I want to show you why I think we can make that claim right there. If you get your Bibles with you, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, because the claim I want to make is that in the oral culture of the first century, acts and teachings could be summarized in oral histories that reliably circulated over long periods of time. I believe that we can make that case very well. We can make it not only from looking at what we're getting ready to in the New Testament, but also looking at other people in the ancient world. Here's a guy named Philo of Alexandria. He gives just an example of this. He speaks how instruction moves in a leisurely way. He's from the first century. He lingers over it, spins it out with repetitions, thus permanently imprinting the thoughts in the hearers' souls. That's how they taught. In other words, they talk about it over and over and over till you memorize it and you pass it on to someone else. Let's take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 15. There's very important cues in this text to let us know that this is the type of thing that was happening in the ancient world at this time. Beginning in verse 3. Paul says, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received." Now I want us to stop right there. I delivered what I received. Paul here introduces two technical terms that let the people know, and they knew these words, they were familiar with these, that let them know he was preparing to present to them an oral history. Paralambano and paradidomi are the words in Greek. It's passed on and received. So what he is doing is making, in some sense, a promise that what I'm about to tell you is the same thing that I received. Now, how do we know Paul's promise was right? How do we know he kept this? We're going to unpack this a little bit more and see why I think we can be reasonably certain that he did. Tell it to them the way he got it. Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. That he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures. He appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, then appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. And then he speaks of James, all the apostles, and then to Paul himself. I want us to unpack this text and work through some things in it. One of the things you see in this text is that there is an odd pattern of and that, and that, and that, and that, that you wouldn't typically be the way you'd write it in Greek. It demonstrates something. What it demonstrates is, most likely, that this comes from some other language. It's translated from some other language. They're trying to translate something in one language into Greek, keeping it pretty much as close as they can to that earlier language, but recognizing you can't translate everything into that. It's an odd pattern that indicates translation. So what was it translated from? What language? Well, let's just know there. He was seen by Cephas, who is Simon Peter, but he doesn't call him Simon Peter. Cephas means Peter or rock in Aramaic. So it comes from an Aramaic source. Well, that's pretty important. There's not a lot of places in the first century that spoke Aramaic. In fact, there's only one region where they spoke Aramaic, and that would be what the region we know as Palestine. So you have just placed this origin in the same place of the life of Jesus. So this is something made up 1,000 miles away. This is something, whatever it is, it comes from, at some level, the region where Jesus himself was. Paul's not from there. He had to have traveled there. When would he have traveled there and gotten this? Well, he tells us this in Galatians 1:17. He says, I talked with, the Greek word is there is historeo, from which we get history. I talked with Simon Peter, he says in Galatians 1:17. Now, Paul, in terms of a human perspective, has every reason not to mention he talked to Peter. Because there's a lot of people that are saying Peter's the real apostle and you're kind of a wannabe apostle, okay? But Paul says, I got this story from Simon Peter. I got the story. I interviewed him. I historiae him. I spoke with him about this. When did Paul do this? Well, he was there with Simon Peter around 35 AD. That's within a few years of the time of Jesus, wasn't it? And by that time, it had already achieved a stable oral tradition pattern to be passed on. Now, how do we know Paul wasn't just changing it? How do we know Paul wasn't changing it? He gets it around Palestine. He gets it most likely within a few years of the time of Jesus. How do we know he's not changing it? Well, here's how we know. First off, remember his context with the Corinthians. The Corinthians are not Paul's biggest fans right now in this letter. In fact, they're looking for opportunities to attack his integrity. So Paul's got to be careful. He's got to be careful about what he says. And he says to them, when I was here 5 years ago, they would have been there 5 years ago, he says, when I was here before, here's what I proclaimed to you. What do you think is going to happen if Paul now writes something different than what he told them 5 years earlier? They're going to jump on it, aren't they? They're going to jump on that. They are going to jump on that. If Paul writes something that he was different, he has got to be carefully putting in exactly what he told them because they are looking for every opportunity to attack his integrity at this point. So we can be reasonably certain that what Paul tells them here is not changed from 5 years earlier. And if he wasn't changing it in that, there's every reason I think that we can say that what he got originally is what he is still passing on generation to generation. To different people of Christians, different groups. Suggest that passages such as this one suggest that accounts of the life of Jesus emerged early in the context of eyewitnesses and remained relatively unchanged as they spread across the Roman Empire. This is just one example. But it shows that this was happening, this oral traditioning, that it was happening coming from the places where Jesus lived, and that it was spreading across the Roman Empire relatively unchanged. Now let's jump into the accounts of the resurrection. I'm going to skip the count of eyewitness because I said that'll take a lot more time than we've got opportunity for here. Testimony about Jesus was formulated soon after his death and circulated reliably. That's the first thing we said. Connected eyewitnesses, you'll have to read the book for that, okay? It's in two books, Misquoting Truth and Conspiracies on the Cross that I've written. So I hate to say that, but that's it. If you really are interested in that, you can read the book on that part there. It was reported in independent accounts that agree in vital details. That's what I want to focus on in the minutes that we have left. Let's take a look at this chart. I want you to get a big picture feel for this. These are five traditions. I'm going to skip this fourth one because there's problematic things about it. So I'm just going to focus on four of them about Jesus, all of which, these four, do not rely on one another. That's important because they use different words for the same things. And you see, if one of them's borrowing from another, that's going to show up because there's going to be certain words they use that are going to be the same words. But these four accounts that I'm getting ready to tell you about, they don't borrow from each other. Now, Matthew, Mark, Luke, they do. Matthew and Luke, it's pretty clear they knew about Mark and are drawing from Mark as they tell their story, okay? Not because that they aren't inspired, but because God inspired them to use an inspired text, okay? And there's nothing wrong with that at all. So that one, it can be counted as one witness. But if you're in a courtroom and you've got two different witnesses, and these two different witnesses each tell a story that agrees in some really interesting details. Not just agrees in general, but some details that, like, man, you wouldn't make that up. And two different ones that didn't talk to each other, you're going to believe what they say. On the other hand, one of the things that would raise suspicion is if everybody told the same story word for word. Because then you'd know you guys got together on this. What is most reliable is accounts that differ in certain things, but also agree in crucial details. That's precisely what you have right here. They differ in some areas, but they agree in crucial details. Let's take a look at them. 1 Corinthians 15 that we already looked at emerges in the early 30s, was written around the year 55. As crucifixion, Jesus raised on the third day, many people saw him alive. Mark chapter 16. Adapted in Matthew 28, Luke 24, so that's, we'll count that as one account. It was written between 65 and 69. It has crucifixion, resurrection on the third day, and an odd detail, Mary Magdalene is witness number one. A woman's witness was never admitted in Jewish court. It was admissible in Roman court under certain conditions. If you're going to fabricate something, you would not fabricate a woman as first witness. You would never fabricate that. You would not fabricate that because of the fact that it's only conditionally acceptable in a courtroom in Roman culture, and it's not admissible at all in Jewish culture. And yet they put a woman as witness number one. John chapter 20, crucifixion, resurrection on the third day, Mary Magdalene as first witness. John does not rely on Mark. There's not verbal stuff going on, similarities between these two. John emerges independently from Mark. And then there's an interesting text, Papyrus Cairo 10759, sometimes called the Gospel of Peter. It shouldn't really be called that, but it's sometimes termed that. But Papyrus Cairo 10759, it does not rely at all on John or on 1 Corinthians or on Mark or Matthew or Luke. It is not similar to any of those in terms of the wording in it. And it's a different account that I don't believe it belongs in the New Testament. I'm not arguing that because it's not the New Testament text all were connected directly to an apostle or somebody connected to an apostle, and this one can't be clearly connected to any of that. So I'm not suggesting it belongs in the New Testament. But it is an important witness. This Egyptian text is a very important witness because it has a different version of the crucifixion and resurrection. But it has crucifixion, resurrection on the third day, and Mary Magdalene as first witness. So what do we have here? We have four separate accounts which agree with one another in crucial details. Three of them agree on a detail that would not likely be fabricated. Just think about that for a moment. What does that demonstrate to you? In any other area of history, this would be said, that must have happened. But the New Testament is often judged by a different standard than other documents. You see, if you applied the standard of that you have to have better evidence than this, you're not going to believe that Hannibal had any elephants. You're not going to believe that that the Tiber River was crossed. You're not going to believe that Maxentius drowned in the Tiber River when he was fleeing from Constantine. You're not going to believe any of those things. Why? Because you've got fewer witnesses than you do for any of those events than you have for this. In those events, you have 1 to 2 witnesses for those events that I described. And we all believe them. This one, we have 4. And yet it's difficult to believe. But why? Well, I can tell you why. We know why. It's because of what we talked about earlier. Fundamentally opposed worldviews. And if I accept this, this changes my whole life. If I accept or deny that Maxentius drowned in the river fleeing from Constantine, it does not change my life. It doesn't change anything about today. If Jesus is alive, that changes everything. That changes everything if Jesus is alive. So I suggest this. If the most consistent historical evidence fits with a miraculous event, there's every reason to believe the miraculous event occurred, especially if independent sources attest to the event. Well, all we're asking for in this is the same standard applied to the New Testament as anything else, as any other historical text. That's all you're saying right here, is have the same thing applied to that. Now, what does this do? This aims us to the life, death, resurrection of Jesus. That's where it aims us toward. Not toward a series of arguments that because at this point, if somebody has to say, Jesus was raised from the dead, and then it comes to a point of I either have to accept or deny that fact of what did he do for me. I have to accept that. Will I recognize that he had access to a source of life I don't have access to, and therefore I have every reason to believe what he said was true? I want to add one last thing about this. I don't know if you realize the degree to which, do you know crucify was a bad word in the ancient world? It's a cuss word. Really was. There's a Latin text in which a prostitute is angry with this client, and as he walks out the door, she says to him, "Go crucify yourself." There's other instances. They would use everything they could not to say the word crucify. They would call it the ultimate punishment. They would call it the criminal beam. They would call it all these different things. The extreme penalty was another one. The extreme penalty is what Suetonius uses when he describes Jesus in the Roman history of Suetonius. He says extreme penalty. He doesn't want to say the word crucify or cross. Why? It's a bad word. It's a nasty word. You see why as you look at something like this. I see the stakes there. This is from the Roman philosopher Seneca. Not of one kind, but of many, some victims are placed head down. Some have spikes driven through their genitals. Others have their arms stretched out on the gibbet. And he goes on and describes the disgusting nature of crucifixion. It's awful. How was it perceived? Here's a bit of graffiti from 2nd century, maybe early 3rd, probably 2nd. Century. People misspelled graffiti then too. That says Sebeta. It should be spelled Sebetai, if you're interested in Greek grammar on that point. It says Alexamenos Sebeta Theon. Alexamenos worships his god. What is implied in that? There's somebody named Alexamenos who believes in a god who's been crucified, who believes in Jesus. And he's being ridiculed in the graffiti on Palatine Hill in Rome because he believes in Jesus. That's crucifixion in the ancient world. You're going to fabricate God on the cross unless it happened. And they aren't going to expect that he comes back. And yet they believed it and testified it so broadly that we have multiple independent testimonies that tell about it and agree in crucial details about this. That's the message we proclaim. It's not necessarily a message that the world wants to hear even then, but that's why they call it apologia, defense. It's one that we have to defend. But it's one that we can defend well, and it is one we can defend in such a way that it's centered not on trying to argue and make our point, but centered on Jesus and on the gospel that comes through him. Anyone have any questions, thoughts, comments, anyone? Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. How do we know that the different accounts of the resurrection weren't all together, so to speak? First off, I would look at, there's a couple of books I would say. Paul Eddy, the Jesus Legend by Paul Eddy, is a pretty good book on that. It's not just on that issue, but on the broader issues as well. Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by Richard Bauckham. Craig Blomberg's book, The Historical Reliability of the Gospels. Those three books I would recommend. I hate to recommend my own books, but I would say also that my book, Conspiracies on the Cross and Misquoting Truth, I deal with some of that in those as well, in that. So that's just some resources to look at. Now, in terms of how we would know that, one of them is literary dependence. That is to say, you would, if they were relying on one another, you would have some phrases that even if they didn't mean to, would get carried over from one to the other, some wording. And that's one of the interesting things is you don't, between those, you don't find carryover of word of like phrases that you think that had been borrowed on that. So that's one reason right there. A second reason would be that we would look at would be, for example, that Paul, the Corinthians, we have a pretty good idea of where it comes from and how it came about. The traditions that are early traditions place, for example, Mark in Rome, around Rome at this time. It would be difficult for him to get with he might have been able to talk to Paul, okay, let's admit he could have talked to Paul, but to get with John, who was over in Ephesus, or to get with whoever wrote papyrus, that papyrus from Cairo, which is evidently Egyptian, them to get together would be, in the ancient world, virtually impossible for them. So simply distance is an issue at that point. It's not to say they couldn't have, but it definitely diminishes the likelihood that they got together on these different things. So that would be two of the initial things you look at in some of these things like this. And then you consider simply the kind of the imprint, so to speak, of the context they're in, the way that they are written for different purposes. It's the same story, but they're written for different purposes and with somewhat different angles on it. It would be difficult to suggest that they were all together at some point to get their story straight with one another, unless the most likely point of that they were together was at some point close to the original story being told in that. And so what you're really trying to do in history, you're not talking about absolute scientific proof, you're talking about probabilities. We're always talking about probabilities. And so we're looking at, you look at all the different options, and the most probable place of getting that is from an original source that was somehow near the actual events. And so that's really kind of methodologically how we follow through in history as well. Good question. Somebody else? Anybody else? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Here, one of the things that has been done, in fact, I spoke at the Society for Secular Students at U of L fairly recently, went and spoke there, and to try to make friends with them. I mean, I really mean that. Make friends with them and let them come and speak to your groups but request that there's a reciprocation in that, that we speak to one another. And to be unabashed about the gospel in that, but to speak to one another. Help them understand that there's and open up that dialogue with them about, but limit it to, not in terms of your friendly dialogue, but in terms of public dialogue, those things that are really gospel issues and things like that. I would encourage that. I spoke there and had just great dialogue, built good connections with some of them there, and they were very open and welcoming. They brought good questions. They brought some questions that I had to say, I honestly don't know the answer to that, but I'll look at it and let's get together and I'll talk to you about it later. We opened up dialogue in that. I think we have to admit to them and do so in a winsome way, of saying, you know what, sometimes Christians are intellectually devoid. And you know what? There's also dumb atheists, too. There's Christians and atheists both that are intellectually not thinking through what they believe. There's both sides. And so we sometimes have to admit and just be upfront and honest. He's like, yeah, you know, right. There's some things that Christians say like that I'm embarrassed about. They're still my brothers. They're still my sisters in Christ. But I am embarrassed by that. And you know what? I bet there's some things that atheists say that you think are pretty dumb too. And so both of us have to admit that. And so that type of an attitude. But really trying to build the friendships. And I spoke a couple of years ago did a series of lectures, two or three lectures at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And it was on Bart Ehrman's home turf, and yet got a chance to interact with a lot of them that were agnostics, and so on, and building relationships. But again, it was simply building the relationship, speaking to them, hearing what they have to say, and gaining a hearing for what you have to say about the gospel. And it takes time and it takes trust, I think. But to make those inroads, and interact with one another. So, yeah. Anyone else? Yeah. To admit, and hear the whole thing I'm saying on this, admit it was put together by people. Okay, it was. But it was put together by people who had a very definite set of reasons for the way they put it together. Focus, I would say, on the New Testament. Just focus on the New Testament, because, as I said, not the Old Testament, that we shouldn't defend it. I'm not trying to suggest that at all. But again, the gospel. Go for the gospel part and talk about the New Testament. There were people that decided that this is in the New Testament. But we find in the earliest days that they had a reason for what they put in. I know it's in my book, Conspiracies and the Cross, but you can pick up some of this different places. Don't just have to look there. But for example, there's a fragment called the Muratorian Fragment. It was probably copied about 160 AD. The original was written in about 160. It's called the Muratorian Fragment, and it's basically saying, here's the books that we believe ought to be in the New Testament. And then it gives the reasons why they were rejecting some. And it says there's this book called Shepherd of Hermas, which was like the purpose-driven life of the ancient world, or the early church. It really was. There's more copies of Shepherd of Hermas than there are of Gospel of Mark. People were reading this all the time. It's a really weird apocalypse of some sort. It's a really strange book, but it was really popular. Some people thought it ought to be part of what they called the books that were read publicly. That was their way of saying authoritative books for the church. That was the phrase they used, was books read publicly. And he said, well, why can't we put this in? And he says, well, the reason we can't is because it's too new to be one of the prophets, one of the Old Testament prophets. It wasn't written by one of the apostles or connected to one of the apostles of Jesus. And plus, it was written in our own generation, and we think we even know who wrote it. And it says who wrote it. So in other words, what's interesting there is you see the reasoning there of that they knew that a book had to either be in the Old Testament, or it had to be connected directly to an apostle of Jesus. And to let them know primarily that there were 20 books in the New Testament that were never questioned by those who were looking at these texts. They were never questioned. They knew from the beginning, absolutely with certainty, this book came from this person, this book came from this person. And we have records in a guy named Papias of these traditions of where they would say, okay, this person wrote this, and when they would convey a text from one church to another to be copied, they would not only convey the text, but they would give an oral tradition saying, this is written by Mark, and here's when he wrote it and how he wrote it. And they would do that. And there's evidences of that from a guy named Papias. There's some in Irenaeus that he got from Polycarp. There's all sorts of different ones that the evidences of that they were doing this. And there were 20 texts that nobody ever questioned. They said, we just know where they came from, and everybody knows where they came from. Now, there were a few books of the New Testament that they weren't just trying to decide, well, does this help us and from our power agenda or any sort of Da Vinci Code thing like that. It's rather that the reason what they were arguing about and trying to figure is, did it really come from an apostle or somebody connected to an apostle? Did it really? We don't know for sure. Did it come from an apostle or somebody connected directly to an apostle? Why did it have to be apostles? Because they were the eyewitnesses of Jesus. And so they had to go back to an eyewitness. And so it was a practice in the pattern that had to go back to an eyewitness. So we can say with confidence that yes, human beings were involved in this, pulling this together. But they had a very definite agenda, yes. But that agenda was not their own agenda. It was, can this be connected with somebody who really saw Jesus? Can we get it connected with that? And so to let them know that, and it's important for people to know that. on just these different issues such as that. I have put for each of you a pamphlet right there. These are some older ones of things I've written to give. What I wanted to do is that give methodologically what I'm talking about here, because even though there's some Da Vinci Code ones and some about the book that was a while back called The Secret, that even though those are old news now, and I know that, it gives you an idea methodologically of how to argue against something in a way that goes toward the gospel, and that's what I want you to see in that. All right, thank you all for being here, and I hope you have a great time here at Southern Seminary.